Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility of a break in the case of 43 missing students that has shocked Mexico and sparked nationwide protests. Mexico City-based journalist Joan Grillo, who is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, joins us to discuss the outrage gripping a country that has experienced decades of mayhem and murder perpetrated by drug gangs, and the possibility that a tip-off from members of a drug gang has led authorities to a mass grave that might relieve the anguish of parents agonized over the fate of their children who disappeared a month ago after clashing with police, who were ordered by the local mayor to intercept the students to prevent them from protesting a speech his wife was giving. She is suspected of being the contact for the drug gang who the police handed the students over to, and she and the mayor have disappeared and are considered fugitives. Then we'll examine Turkey's decision to allow Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga fighters to cross its territory to join the fight against the Islamic State, who have besieged the Syrian border town of Kobani since September. Edmund Garib, an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq and author of The Kurdish Question in Iraq and the Kurdish Nationalist Movement, joins us to discuss the significance of this limited cooperation by Turkey, while at the same time Ankara continues to bar the U.S. access to the NATO base at Incirlik, Turkey, which forces U.S. aircraft engaged in the bombing of ISIS targets in order to lift the siege of Kobani to fly longer distances and refuel by air. Then finally, we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, for an update on the October 1st political murder of a rising young star of the governing party, Socialist Deputy Robert Serra, who was stabbed to death along with his partner, Maria Herrera. Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK Guardian, joins us to discuss what factors promised Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to announce on Monday a thorough purge of the police, accusing a group in the Caracas force of being, quote, at the service of Colombian paramilitary mafias to kill this leader of the Venezuelan youth. And joining us now is Joan Grillo, who is a senior correspondent for Global Post, who is based in Mexico City and has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, The Associated Press, PBS, NewsHour, The Houston Chronicle, CBC, and The Sunday Telegraph. He has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador, and is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo. Well, apparently we're not getting through. Have you tried his cell phone number as well? I don't know. Hello, are you there, Joan?
Yeah, I'm here now, yes.
Okay. Joan, in the introduction, I just mentioned in broad strokes this extraordinary story in a country that's been beset by so much drug violence, much of it beyond belief in its horror, yet the entire nation is galvanized over the fate of these 43 missing students who disappeared. They were about to protest a speech given by the mayor, the wife of a mayor of a town or a city in the south of Guerrero State. The police then rounded up these students, put them in buses, and then apparently turned them over to a drug gang that the mayor's wife is connected to. And since the students disappeared, both the mayor and his wife have disappeared too, and they are considered fugitives. So is it that naked and that extraordinary a story of abuse, criminality, etc.?
I think it's an incredibly blatant case of corrupt power and drug traffickers working with politicians. This, as you said, a problem that's gone on in Mexico for some time. But now we've seen in this case such a horrific crime when you have 43 students disappearing at once, 43 young people from 17 to their early 20s. People who are training to be teachers who, in the communities they're looking to come back and serve them, to see them disappear and to see the government after 1 month incapable of finding them, and to see the mayor and a whole bunch of mayors and police officers in the area working with drug gangs. This has really infuriated people in Mexico, really, you know, at the end of their tether of where this can lead.
And what impact is it having on the new president, Peña Nieto?
Well, President Peña Nieto has tried very hard to change Mexico's image. He wants to change it from all the time being centered on violence, corruption, and drug trafficking, and say that Mexico's a modernizing country with a big middle class, a country to invest in. And that's a fair enough agenda to try and bring attention to the more positive things. But this has really shattered that image. We've now got the whole world looking at Mexico at exactly those three things: violence, corruption, political corruption, and drug trafficking. And this has been a real thorn, you know, a real thorn in the side. There's this idea generated and talked about by some pundits of a thing called Mexico's moment. This was a time that Mexico is going to become one of the great nations and really expand. And that idea of Mexico's moment has been shattered with the disappearance of these 43 students.
So the governor of Guerrero State has been forced to resign, Angel Aguirre. That happened last week. The mayor of this town in the south of Guerrero, where the students disappeared, Jose Luis Abaca, apparently, well, he's disappeared along with his wife, Maria de Los Angeles Pineda Villa, and she was about to give a speech, apparently, and the students showed up, presumably to disrupt this speech, and the police showed up and they grabbed the students. It was all very public, put them in buses, and then they disappeared. And apparently they handed them over to the drug gang. And apparently the wife of the mayor has been identified as the gang's main political contact.
Yes, I mean, there's a bit more confusion about some of the details exactly of that account. The students have gone to the town to abscond with some buses, which they use. Basically, it's quite a radical tradition of students in this part of Mexico who come from poor rural backgrounds and are trained to be teachers. And a lot of them, they follow Che Guevara, follow kind of certain strands of left-wing tradition. Now, they often, you could say, borrow buses. They take commercial buses, offer these demonstrations, and generally return them, and the bus companies complain about that. Now, they were actually planning, and this is a very sad paradox, they were planning to take the buses to go to a demonstration in Mexico City to commemorate a massacre of students in 1968 by Mexican soldiers in Tlatelolco Square. So they wanted to commemorate a massacre of students half a century ago, and then maybe became victims of massacre themselves. Now, it's still a little bit blurry what led to their detention. You had, indeed, the mayor's wife giving a speech in the square. They might not have even gone deliberately to disrupt it, but the authorities became very angry at the presence of these students in the town stealing these buses or borrowing, absconding with these buses, and then sent police to arrest them or to stop them. Angry scene ensued. The police tried to block the students from leaving. Some of the students got out of the bus and then very quickly escalated into the police firing on the students and actually killed several of the students there. They shot them dead. Actually, three students were dead and also some passers-by. A man who was driving in his taxi with his passenger was killed. A local football team, soccer team, was driving through the area and some members of that team were killed as well. So the police firing, but also along with the police, there were these gunmen, cartel gunmen, not in uniform, operating as well. The situation escalated. There was then a pause for a bit where the students, in fact, even talked to some journalists on the scene, said they'd been shooting at us. And then the police attacked them again and took away these members and handed them, we presume, to a drug cartel afterwards. It's still hard to identify exactly when the order was made, to give them to Drucker and to disappear them. But I think one of the things we can really see from this is you have a town authority which is effectively captured and controlled by drug traffickers. There's a drug cartel in the area called Guerreros Unidos, or Warriors United. They grow opium, used to heroin in the area, they grow marijuana, they smoke, make crystal meth. A drug cartel, and they control the town authority. And when you get this combination of a drug cartel and a corrupt town authority, you start getting a modus operandi where they react to a public disturbance with kind of drug cartel violence. That effectively the power in the area operating, committing horrific violence to maintain that power.
And as I mentioned, Joan Grillo, the mayor of Iguala, Jose Luis Abaca, is on the lam in hiding. He's a fugitive along with his wife, Maria de Los Angeles Pineda. She's apparently the sister of two major drug cartel lieutenants. And apparently it's some members of this drug gang who've confessed to the police, and presumably not the same police that handed them over to the drug gang, but I imagine federal police are in there investigating. And this has led to this garbage tip where they are looking for the bodies. Have they found the bodies yet of these 43 students?
No, they haven't given a positive identity yet, of the students. They initially found a mass or a series of mass graves outside the town of Iguala. And, I was up at that mass grave when they were taking out bodies, and you could smell the smell of rotten human flesh there. In that area of mass graves, they've said they found at least 38 bodies in the first wave of mass graves, and they're not the students. So, I mean, you've not only got 43 students disappeared and a bunch of people killed, another 38 bodies, unidentified, and who do they belong to? They've now then come to this garbage dump and are looking, and they have various forensic people there, and there are bodies there in the dump. They're saying we don't know how many. We don't know yet if they do belong to the students or if that's the case or not. So they're still working on that. But like you say, yes, the wife of the mayor indeed was the sister of several people. Three had three brothers. One had been shot dead in a cartel-related killing, and another one had been imprisoned. And it's quite incredible that the politicians, the whole political system, allowed this family, this person, to take power in this city.
Well, the governor who resigned or was forced to resign, he was replaced by a PRD governor, which is the left-wing party. What was the incumbent governor? What was party did he belong to? And what party does this mayor, this fugitive mayor, and his criminal wife belong to?
So, actually, both the previous governor and the mayor were part of the supposedly left-wing PRD, the Democratic Revolution Party. And this, as well as being a blow to Peña Nieto, is a huge blow to the PRD, to Mexico's opposition left. Mexico's opposition left is always saying we're against repression by the state, we're against police killings, and then their own politicians are found allying with narcos to massacre students, to disappear students. So a real blow to the PRD. We'll see if this new interim governor, who is in fact not really a hardcore party man, but he's somebody with long left-wing sympathies. Himself, he was kind of part of a small guerrilla group back in the 1970s, a university guy, an intellectual. And it's interesting that in Mexico that so many politicians are so badly stained by corruption, they're kind of turning to academics to see if they can do any better in governing these places.
So just in closing then, Joan Grillo, what's the, as I mentioned in the beginning, it's pretty extraordinary that the Mexican public, so weary of this failed war on drug, with all of this collateral damage from innocent people being murdered in all the mayhem that happens and mass graves are discovered. What is it about this that's really sparked this outrage? And frankly, I'm surprised that it hasn't gotten more publicity here in the United States, because apparently it is a big deal in Mexico.
I think in this case, seeing 43 students in one place disappearing, you know, really hit them. It's an outrageous crime. You can have disappearances, you know, north, south, east, and west of, you know, two people here, three people there, one person there, and many people crying individually. But to see a crime on this scale, and of people with nothing to do with the drug trade, young students, they protest, but they're nothing to do with drug trafficking or nothing in this world, becoming victims, really galvanizes people. And also particularly students. Students across Mexico have been protesting, blockading roads, and having some solidarity. People are extremely weary of this. We've seen now a good 8 years of drug-related violence at very high levels. And people are fed up trying to get on with their lives. Sometimes there's tipping points and people just go out and say, oh, we cannot stand any longer.
Well, Jan Grillo, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Johan Grillo, who is a senior correspondent for Global Post, who is based in Mexico City and has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador, and is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Turkey's decision to allow Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga fighters to cross its territory. ¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias de el narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edmund Garib, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds in Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and was formerly a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. His books include The Historical Dictionary of Iraq, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which was co-authored with Majid Haduri. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edmund Garib.
Thank you.
And what do you make of Turkey allowing more than 160 Iraqi Kurdish fighters, the Peshmerga, to go through its territory in order to relieve the siege of Kobani on the Turkish-Syrian border, which has been under attack now since September by the Islamic State?
Well, Turkey has been under a lot of pressure recently. Turkey has faced pressure from the United States. It's facing pressure from some of the neighbors. Some of its Kurdish population also wanted support from Turkey against the Islamic State. And on top of that, Turkey is also very much worried about the internal situation inside Turkey, where there have been recently revival of protests and some clashes between the Kurdish Workers' Party, which is a Kurdish nationalist party which has been fighting against Turkey actually off and on since the early 80s. And at one time it demanded independence and unity for all of the Kurdish areas in the Middle East, both the Kurds of Iraq, the Kurds of Iran, the Kurds of Syria, and the Kurds of Turkey. So Turkey is coming under a great deal of pressure as a result of all of these factors. And the United States has been somewhat miffed, actually, because Turkey has not moved to help the Islamic State siege of Kobani. And there has been disappointment also because of Turkey's policies, which either have looked the other way or have not been very effective in stopping jihadists to go into Syria through Turkish territory, as well as the smuggling of oil from areas under the Islamic State's control to Turkey. So for a variety of reasons, Turkey, which had initially wanted to have zero problems with all of its neighbors, ended up having more problems with its neighbors as a result of its policy vis-a-vis Syria and vis-a-vis the Kurds. One of the interesting things that you pointed to, which is the idea of allowing 160, there have been different numbers given. At one time they said it was going to be 200. Then we heard it was going to be 150 from the Turkish President Erdogan. But this is a very, very important point, which has put, again, new pressures and raised new criticisms from within Turkey on President Erdogan, because the idea of having Kurds from Iraqi Kurds, helping Syrian Kurds, might raise the idea that this is very legitimate and it would legitimize in the future support by the Kurds of Iraq, of Syria, of Iran, to Turkey's Kurds, who are, in case the negotiations which had started between the Kurdish Workers' Party of Turkey and the Turkish government collapse.
But Edmund Garib, why is it then that Turkey is sort of reluctantly helping the Kurds at the same time only Iraqi Kurds and not Syrian Kurds, and yet to help lift the siege of Kobani? So why is they're giving this limited cooperation on the one hand, while at the same time Ankara continues to bar the U.S. access to the NATO base at Incirlik, which forces U.S. aircraft engaged in the bombing of the Islamic State targets in Kobani, where they're trying to lift the siege? The U.S. aircraft have to fly longer distances and refuel by air. So if you want to get rid of the Islamic State and stop the siege of Kobani, wouldn't you want to help the U.S. Air Force?
Absolutely, you would think so. But again, I think to understand Turkey's position, Turkey has been very much reluctant in becoming involved in allowing the U.S. to use its air bases, as you have said, basically, or the air base at Incirlik and perhaps some of the others. You have to remember one in around 2003, before the Iraq war, Turkey, at that time, all the major political groups inside Turkey, be they the Islamists of the ruling party, of Erdogan's party, be it the leftists, be it the Communist Party, be it the nationalists, be it the secular nationalists, all of them were opposed to supporting U.S. intervention in Iraq and allowing the use of Turkish territory. There was a lot of pressure put on Turkey at that time, and Turkey refused. And by the time the parliament decided to take the issue, it was a bit too late, and it didn't. Even then, there was no approval. Primarily at that time, all Turkish political factions were concerned about the Kurds and the possibility that the breakup of Iraq might lead to the emergence of Kurdish state inside Iraq. That state ultimately is going to be a model for their own Kurds. If there are 5.5 million Kurds in Iraq, can establish a state of their own, why can't 18 to 22 million Kurds in Turkey have a state of their own, or at least a federal arrangement in case the Iraqi Kurds don't go their own way and establish their own state? So that is, I think, one factor. The second reason is that Turkey has always, or the Turkish government, let's put it that way, has put as one of its objectives in the region the collapse, the overthrow of the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. The Turkish government has supported various opposition groups, armed groups, as well as some of the moderate elements against the Syrian regime. And when the U.S. was talking to Syria, we heard we're talking with Turkey about using its air bases, about possible Turkish support for the resistors at Kobani. The Turkish president said that he wants to see a no-fly zone over Syria. He wanted to have an area that would be a safe haven area near from Kobani and near the border between Syria and Turkey. And basically, he wanted to have a role, especially for the Free Syrian Army, which has, in the past, has not had a good relationship with the PYD, which is the Kurdish party, which dominates this area of Syria. And so as a result of this, we saw that the tensions actually were raised between the United States and Turkey. Ultimately, the U.S. decided to go ahead on its own to launch some air attacks against the Islamic State near Kobani even before Turkey approved or agreed to do so. That put increasing pressure on the Turkish government, and the reaction came by basically saying they would allow like 200 fighters from the Peshmerga of Iraq, of Kurdish Iraq, to come to the aid of the Kurds of Syria. And so as a result, but yet it still taking quite a bit of time, and the Turkish government and some of the Syrian Kurds also have expressed some reservations about this, because they both said that there are some technical problems which had prevented the coming of the Iraqi Kurds. And even 200, let's say 500 fighters come, that by itself is not going to be sufficient. It would be significant support. It would provide some aid, but it's not going to be enough. Now, the final point that I would like to make, and I don't know if that will answer your question, but basically one of the point that you said about the different responses to Syria's Kurds versus Iraq's Kurds. Turkey has had a very troubled relationship with the government in Baghdad under Prime Minister Maliki. Turkey also needs energy, needs oil, and they had hoped that basically using Iraq's Kurdish oil in northern Iraq, and they have been supportive of the Kurdish regional government inside Iraq to discover new oil fields, and at the same time to build a pipeline from Iraqi Kurdistan through Turkey to bring the oil from Iraqi Kurdistan. Also, Turkey has had close to $9 billion worth of investments in Iraqi Kurdistan. So Turkey has good relations with the Kurdish regional government, which also has an interest in maintaining a good relationship with Turkey, because it's becoming a bit dependent on Turkey to export its oil and to get investments, etc., since it was having a difficult time. It's having serious problems with the Baghdad government. So I think that helps explain, in part, the reason why we're seeing close cooperation with Erbil, but not necessarily close cooperation with the PYD or the Syrian Kurds, who Turkey accuses of having close relationship with the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party of Turkey. And so as a result of this, you're seeing these contradictions. And this is part of the problem of this whole, what's going on in the region. It's such a complicated issue. You see so many different interests, different alliances, and that's what's making it difficult to get everybody on board.
So, Edmund Gharib, then if, you know, clearly one of the more effective ways to take on the Islamic State would be to defund them, because they stole about $500 million in Mosul. Apparently, they still get money from Saudi Arabia and wealthy Gulf Arabs who are sympathetic to that Wahhabi Salafist kind of fundamentalism. But their main source of income, my understanding, is from the oil fields that they've captured. And all of this oil, this black market oil, as far as I know, goes through Turkey. So how come Turkey can't, they can stop Kurdish fighters from crossing the border into Kobani, but they can't stop oil, black market oil, flowing across their borders to the market?
Well, that's a very good point, actually. And it's, I think, first of all, the Islamic State is getting their funding through different ways. There are some pathetic business people and people in different parts of the Middle East who are providing support. But they also, for example, they have been selling antiquities. And this is, they are robbing the antiquities in Iraq and Syria and selling them abroad. And they're making a lot of money from that. There have been kidnappings. So the people who, they kidnap some business people as well as the other, for example, prominent figures, and sometimes they ask, they have been asking for ransom. So that's another source of income. They have a certain tax paid where small businesses are also paying them some money, which is important for them, in addition to the oil. It seems that now we are seeing a belated effort on the part of Western powers, including the United States, as well as some of the Gulf countries, to try to cooperate together, to put pressure on those individuals and companies which are involved in the smuggling and the selling of oil through Turkey. Of course, it's not going to be easy, because some of these people don't have money overseas or in international banks. And nevertheless, I think this is at least the first effort. And there is increasing pressure on Turkey as well to try to also take steps to limit, if not to completely stop, the smuggling of oil through its territory.
So you mentioned earlier, Edmund Gharib, how there are, what, up to 20 million Kurds inside of Turkey who are probably inspired by what's happening in northern Iraq, this first Kurdish state, this de facto Kurdish state in the north of Iraq, which is the only part of Iraq that works, that's not totally beset by violence and instability. Yet everybody seems to not want to recognize the obvious that Iraq is no longer a state. You know, the Americans, the Iranians, the Turks, everybody seems to want to maintain this fiction that there's still an Iraq that we can save. So what is behind that collective delusion?
Well, I think this is a very, very good, issue to raise. Why is it that almost all of these states are concerned about which appears to be crumbling? I mean, there's no doubt that the invasion of 2003, the sanctions before that, the war previously, had a devastating impact on Iraq. The dismantling of the Iraqi military, of the Iraqi police, of Iraqi institutions in 2003 contributed to this sad situation that we are finding now. But what the reason, the main reason why, is that Iraq, if Iraq breaks up along sectarian or ethnic lines, this will not stop at the borders of Iraq. This will extend almost to all every other state or most of the states in the region, because most of these states are made up of a variety of ethnic and religious communities. And if you begin to have people divided and identified along their basic religious or sectarian or the tribal or ethnic identity, then everybody, every state, including Syria, including Turkey, including Iran, including, I mean, all the states in the region, probably the only state that would be cohesive in that part of the world in terms of its ethnicities would be Egypt. You have to go to Egypt. And even then, there would be tensions, some sectarian tensions. So that's why everyone is very much concerned about the Sykes-Picot borders. and about the idea which was born actually after the Treaty of Westphalia, where the state with its national borders more or less sacred, although in reality what we have seen in recent decades is that some of these borders have been violated time and time again. And we've seen, and this is something that's extremely dangerous, we've seen the rise of the militias, the paramilitaries, who also cross the borders, like the Islamic State, like and other such organizations.
But the tragedy of the of what's happening now is that you have these militias, and particularly the Islamic State, that is bent, that are bent upon literally eradicating, in a genocidal way, all religious minorities, and that seems to me to be what needs to be preserved, a little bit of diversity here.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the most important issues, I think. The Middle East, and especially some of these countries, for example, if we take a look at, Iraq, if we take a look at Syria, if we take a look at Iraq, there are ethnic and religious communities which go back, have their roots deep in the history of that of those countries and of the region as a whole. Iraqi Christians, for example, before 2003, there were probably close to 1.4 million Iraqi Christians. Those Christians are native Iraqi. They are not converts. There are some few converts here and there, but those are native Christians whose roots in Christianity go back to the first Christian century. You have religious groups such as the Sabaeans, the Mandaeans, who have three or four thousand years. You have the Yazidis, who were attacked by the Islamic State in the Sinjar Mountains and are a very, very unique religious community. Again, they are threatened with extinction, and they have suffered, they, along with all the other minorities, have suffered extensively. And that's why I think two things. One, it's very important that there has to be an international effort to raise awareness about the dangers to these communities, vulnerable communities. And also, I think sometimes it would have been very important as well to take that into account. I mean, before, for example, becoming involved in invasions or against countries, or in adopting policies without truly understanding the consequences of those policies.
But given you've explained to us why there is reluctance on the part of the neighboring powers and the United States to recognize the reality that Iraq is pretty much no longer exists as a unitary country. So the fact that they're denying this doesn't mean it's not going to continue to evolve in the way that it is. So what will Iraq look like in a few years' time if the southern Shiite part ends up being a sort of greater Iran? That would obviously have massive consequences for Iranian oil. They would be a more powerful producer than Saudi Arabia. And we know that Kurdistan in the north, the Kurdish Republic, is moving ahead and creating a very model society there. And the people that are left out are the Sunnis.
You know, this is I really like these that you're raising, because they go to the heart of the problems that the region is facing. The marginalization of the Sunnis is in part what led or contributed greatly to the rise of these radical groups such as the Islamic State, because the Islamic State was not, despite what some people think, was not born in Syria. It was born in Iraq, actually. The marginalization of the Sunni has contributed to an environment which basically has led to the growth of this movement, as well as perhaps external support. But the danger, however, remains. First of all, if we take a look at the Kurdish issue, the Kurdish state, as long as you have Turkey and Iran opposed to the idea of establishing a Kurdish independent state, it's going to be very, very difficult for the Iraqi Kurdish state to really become true independent. Either then they are going to be dependent on one of these two states, Turkey or Iran, and that could lead to major confrontations both within the Kurdish region as well as between these two countries. At the same time, the other danger also is that if you have these three states fragmenting and, you know, three entities, a Shiite entity in the south, a Sunni entity in the center, and a Kurdish entity in the north, there is going to be a very bloody struggle going on after these states try to set up their independence or create independent states, because they are going to be fighting over oil, over water, over borders. So this is going could bring greater, much greater violence down the road than we have seen so far.
Well, Edmund Gharib, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Edmund Gharib, who is an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and was formerly a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. His books include The Historical Dictionary of Iraq, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Haduri. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Caracas, Venezuela for an update on the October 1st political murder of a rising young star of the governing party. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. Her latest article at The Guardian is Venezuela's President Promises to Revamp Country's Police Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Virginia. And we started out the program talking about how Mexico now is gripped by the case of the 43 missing students who have been missing for a whole month. And now it's sort of come to a head. And it seems equally strange that in Caracas, in Venezuela, this rising young star of the governing party, the socialist deputy, Robert Serra, who was stabbed to death along with his partner, Maria Herrera. That happened back on October the 1st, but it seemed to have come to a head now with the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, replacing the attorney general and the announcement that a number of policemen have been arrested. So fill us in, if you will, on this burgeoning scandal.
Well, like you said, it was almost a month ago, and it's, you know, the government's initial reaction was to think that right-wing groups were behind the murder. This was partly due because the Minister of Justice had been sort of leading investigations into the February protests, and one of the things, or one of the findings, were a series of videos of sort of a radical activist in exile in Colombia, claiming that that the best strategy to sort of oust the Maduro government would be to kill key figures in the Chavismo group. So anyway, I think, you know, after those videos, came out, and then Serra's death occurred so shortly after the investigation sort of seemed to go that way. But like you said, it's now been a month. I think close to 9 people have been detained for the murder, including 2 police officers who were part of the assassination. Maduro has said several times that that he has the name and has identified the intellectual authors of the assassination, but these have yet to be released. So yes, the Minister of Interior and Justice, who had been leading this investigation, was sort of forced out of his post on Friday, and a new minister has been named.
Well, it seems that President Maduro is trying to blame Colombia's ex-president Alvaro Uribe for being behind what Maduro claims are these right-wing Colombian-based paramilitaries who have, as he said, who have somehow recruited elements in the Caracas police force, who Maduro is accused of being at the service of Colombian paramilitary mafias, to kill this leader of the Venezuelan youth. He also went on to say that there were attempts against the life of the president of the National Assembly, Diosdado Cabello, and the Minister of Education, Hector Navarro, and that these attacks were prevented in the days following Serra's assassination. So, is there any truth to this? Is what's the evidence that there's this war being waged trying to kill off the leadership of the Venezuelan government?
Well, there hasn't been any sort of concrete evidence shown to the public, other than, like I said, these sort of videoed Skype conversations of this very young radical activist claiming that would be the best way to oust the government. But other than that, it's just been these sort of forewarnings of Maduro saying that he will soon present the evidence, but we've yet to see what this evidence is. He's also said that that it was a hired killing that cost close to $250,000, and that he knows exactly who paid the money and how it was sort of disbursed. But like I said, these details haven't been shared with the Venezuelan public.
But it does seem that what is going on here, particularly with the dismissal of the former attorney general, is this gray line, this blurring between illegal arms and legal arms, because the government of Venezuela and particularly under the revolutionary founder, if you will, of the Bolivarian Revolution, Hugo Chavez, and Maduro, his successor, has continued arming the so-called colectivos. And that's what was at issue over the handling of these clashes between pro-government armed groups, these colectivos. So where does that stand? I mean, how can you tell? I mean, you have to put this in context, that Venezuela, according to the United Nations, has the highest crime rate in the world, second only to Honduras.
For close to a decade, the late President Chavez had a policy of sort of creating these defenders of the revolution. Many of them were police, ex-police, or had somehow gotten, access to guns or even gun permits. So it became quite evident how powerful they were back in February when the street protests erupted that left 43 people dead. And oftentimes, these sort of armed men in motorcycles would intimidate protesters, and also sort of, they were seen often in these sort of photographs or protesters' videos riding alongside government security forces. The fact that that the government had been so permissive towards this group was quite evident back then. Again, more recently, and sort of the relationship with the Serra murders is still quite vague. But it is true that just 2 days after Serra was assassinated gruesomely, the Minister of Interior and Justice, who was leading the investigation, also sort of directed presided over a clash between the intelligence police unit and some of members of these colectivos. The ex-minister of justice denied that there was any relationship, but I think that's still quite vague. But what was quite evident, again, is that following the murder or the killing of two of the colectivo leaders during the clashes, the other members of the colectivos basically threatened to protest and demand the dismissal of Minister Torres, which in effect did happen, shortly after. So yeah, like you said, I think this is further evidence that the government has been, sort of had a very permissive attitude towards these armed groups to the point where they are now exerting increasing influence over sort of political decisions.
Well, apparently, Rocio San Miguel, the president of Citizens Control, which is an NGO in Venezuela that monitors human rights and the armed forces, he's quoted, in fact, it's quoted in your article at The Guardian, the boundaries between the groups who possess weapons legally and those who have them illegally are blurred. Now, if there is, if we are to believe President Maduro, that the police have been infiltrated by right-wing cartels, allied groups from Colombia, my understanding is that it's pretty difficult to know in terms of Colombian drug gangs and the extent to which they corrupt the government and the military and the police. Some of them are left-wing, like the FARC, and some of them are the remnants of right-wing paramilitaries as well. So, I mean, is there any clarity on who's infiltrating the police, whether they're right-wing or left-wing associated cartels?
Yeah, according to President Maduro, it was, sort of right-wing Colombian paramilitary groups who basically bought off two police officers who then basically participated and aided in the murder of Serra. The guy who is sort of charged with the actual killing is according to Maduro, a Colombian citizen with links to paramilitary groups in that, neighboring nation. But that's quite different from the colectivos, which again are Venezuelan sort of defenders of the revolution that have a long-standing tradition in several neighborhoods here, but that certainly preceding Chavez, but certainly under Chavez they were strengthened and revitalized and perhaps even Ms. San Miguel says. Allowed to have access to weapons.
But this rising young star, the socialist deputy, Robert Serra, he was wasn't he often on television defending the revolution? So what would the relationship be between the armed colectivos? I mean, there's clearly some blurred lines here because I spoke with a Venezuelan friend who was close friends with a former senior intelligence official in the Chavez government. In fact, he was the guy that in many ways saved Chavez's life in the 92 coup against him, which the Bush White House either actively or tacitly approved of. And this guy was, I think, murdered about 5 or 6 months ago, shot 5 or 6 times. And it was alleged that there was some of the Chavistas had been corrupted by the drug cartels.
I'm going by what President Maduro has sort of officially said. This case, the Serra murder, is just so rife with rumors from all different natures that it's still quite hard to say what exactly went on. The murder of Eliezer Otaiza, the man that you've just described, it has also still to be clarified. I mean, there's, you know, people were charged with his murder, but it sort of largely went by as a, just the sort of result of violent street crime. But with Serra's murder, it's now yet another Chavista figure who's been killed. And like Maduro said, it seems that there's growing concern that this might actually be the beginning of a wave of political violence. Certainly that's what the president of the National Assembly, Diosdado Cabello, said. He said publicly that he feared for his life after the Serra murder. I think it's indicative that there's deep divisions within Chavismo that had previously sort of been kept at bay. I think also that it's undeniable that there's a problem with impunity and crimes often go unsolved. And certainly I think that we're sort of seeing that the government no longer has a monopoly of violence, and that these groups that were originally meant to somehow defend the revolution or act sort of as the barriers to protesters could very easily turn against the government. You know, there was certainly a lot of discontent after these five members of the colectivos were killed shortly after Serra's murder. It was quite a dramatic incident. In fact, one of them, the leader of the Cinco de Marzo colectivo, had just appeared on TV directly blaming Minister Torres for anything that could happen to him. And then just basically within hours, he was dead. So it's certainly an incident that has shocked the nation, and we're still sort of trying to sort the ripple effect of it.
But just in the last second, are they blaming the U.S. or at this point, or is it just blaming the Colombians?
I'm sorry?
Is the government blaming the U.S. or are they blaming the Colombians? They usually blame the U.S.
Originally Maduro has blamed groups, within the right-wing side of the opposition being financed by the U.S. But now it's been mainly Colombia's ex-president Álvaro Uribe undetermined paramilitary group.
Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us, Virginia Lopez.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom in Caracas, Venezuela. And she's has an article at The Guardian, Venezuela's president promises to revamp country's police force. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.